something. I just have a lot of problems with that. Okay. But anyway, so you had, see, I didn't have any police constabulary.
Oh, and there was a police force there too, and the,
well,
and the
I mean,
chief of police was yeah. another person.
Well, in the, police yeah. constabulary were not police. There were municipal police, but police constabulary were kind of like national, mobilized National Guard.
Yeah.
And they were 40 kilometers to the road and then 6 kilometers up to the provincial capital. So there was no way to get in touch with them. So I was really out and exposed.
Yeah.
You know, they could have at any time.
Yeah.
But you had Royal Lao troops in your village, plus an airfield, you said.
Well, what I was saying, there, and it was a place where the CIA would drop people off because we were fairly close to the Ho Chi Minh Trail.
Uh-huh.
And so there was a fair amount of CIA activity, you know, through the village.
Uh-huh.
So it was
just passing through, but nonetheless through the village.
Well, but through the village and Prince Benun again.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah.
And the Chao Quang, you know,
yeah.
all that type of stuff.
Okay.
And
so this was the center of their activity.
Yeah, and it's another interesting little story is that we had a John Kerchick had a Lao girlfriend cook.
Uh-huh.
So when he left, thank goodness she left, and she wasn't a very good cook. Like a cook at all.
That was just a phony job title.
That's right. And so I think it was Paul Altimus, as a matter of fact. Anyway, we were I cooking for myself, and I was in Savannah Kit. Eating at the our favorite Chinese restaurant, really great Chinese restaurant, and I said, boy, could we eat like this all the time? And I'm like, what if the cook would go come work for us, you know, because it would be a, you know. So we walked around to the alley and asked to see the cook, and it was a Vietnamese.
Uh-huh.
And told me, yeah, I know who you are, you know, and you know, we're looking for a cook. Do you know anybody? We didn't address him directly. He says, I'll come work for you. And we said, what, can we come back and get you? He took off his apron.
The owner of that place must have hated you guys.
Probably about a communist threat. The economic threat would be worse. Well, the problem was, he was a good cook.
Uh-huh.
He cooked good French food because he'd worked for a French military during the French occupation.
Uh-huh.
And so, and you could talk to him, and he knew just enough English, and between the little Lao I knew, what little English he knew, we could work things out, and he'd cook anything.
Uh-huh.
And you just tell him, well, I'd like this, and I think it's made of this, this, and this, and he'd try it, and is this it? No, it's missing, you know, so, and you'd get it. It was just fantastic. You can't believe, you know, how well I lived for 18 months, you know, and
Kingdom
for the time. The problem was, the spooks found out about it. The CIA.
Yeah.
And since they were landing at the airport, passing through, they started showing up for lunch.
Oh, no.
So we had
you don't want those guys around.
So we had to get the, but I mean, they'd bring, you know, food, and they'd bring the, you know, leaves were prepared, and, you know, drink of alcohol. You know, they were paying their way, but, you know, so I had to get the area coordinator, Savannah Kevin, to say, hey, well, tell these guys to quit this. And then he had the timidity to try to hire
this guy away from you, just like you did with him.
That's
so,
right.
Well, what goes around comes around.
Yeah, the spooks, but he wasn't dead. He was, again, he was loyal. I mean, and he'd go to the villages with us, to, and you know, when we go out and party in the evening,
uh-huh.
he'd go out with us, and he became quite a man about town. Too, so he's having great fun. Right?
Yeah.
He wouldn't go anywhere else. Work for anybody else. But anyway.
And maybe he actually didn't like the CIA types.
Yeah, because that was strictly cooking, probably.
Yeah.
But for us, he cooked, you know, two or three people, maybe five or six once every week or two.
Uh-huh.
So it was nice.
I was just listening to that air conditioner, and I don't know if that is affecting things or not, but, you know, it's not really hot in here.
Well,
no,
it's time
like
to come on at a certain time, so about...
Oh, is that so?
It comes on and then runs during until it goes off about 4 o'clock.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but it maintains the temperature, so I've been, the temperature has gotten a little low for it, so anyway.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, no. I'm not uncomfortable.
No,
I didn't think that, you know, yeah, so better just off for a bit. No, that's a good story.
Yeah.
Yeah, you live very well.
Oh, extremely well for that. compared to what I'm sure your situation, you're probably comfortable, you made it comfortable, but for me, I mean, to the Philippines, but for me, you know, I'd live like a king out there for 18 months.
Well, I didn't live like a king, but I was sponsored in part by a American Catholic priest who was with the Columban Order, and Columban Missionary Order, and he had this guy who would go around and to the schools to do, God, I forget what the title of that, not catechist, maybe it was catechist. We would go around to schools and give little religious instruction and stuff like that. And he operated in the hinterland region and out of our house. And he might be off for a day here or a day there, but he was in our house a lot, and he was a great cook. Probably not as good as yours. Okay, so he was a good cook. Yours was a great one, you know, from the sound of it.
This guy really was. I can't believe it.
So, in looking at time here, because it's already 20 past 10, we don't have that much left. I got to unfortunately get beyond the first 2 years.
That's right.
You know,
but I haven't told you all my stories yet.
I know that's always the problem. But I think I've got a firm idea. In the sense of the rapport that you were able to establish and how you tried to work with villagers while also remaining true to the Lao sponsors, and that you really, really were more with the Laotians as an autonomous people rather than seeing yourself simply as an adjunct to AID in terms of your day-by-day operations.
Exactly.
You know, and I think that's an important part of a volunteer experience. Why did you want to become associate chief of party and move away from this idyllic sort of existence rather than just add on another year? Because you went on to associate for a year.
Yeah, Kinkaq was not necessarily the most ideal place. It was a flat plain. It could get very hot and dusty. And,
okay.
I mean,
So you wanted a Swiss chalet.
That's right. I want to take my cook. I was finished. I'd experienced that. I had made some overtures to AID to go work for them, and Chet Brown had an opening as associate chief and asked me that, and I wasn't quite ready to come back to the States. Didn't know what I was going to do if I did come back to the States, and so I said, okay, sure. So it was nothing better to do.
So you chose that though rather than pursuing AID?
Yeah, they didn't pursue me, so I'm not so sure whether there was an option there or not. I just don't know,
Well, I know that many IBS people did go on to AID, maybe only for a short contract, but nonetheless they did.
But I think, too, I was still, thought I had something to give, and I wasn't quite sure that aid was the right way to do things in Laos, move to the idealism, too. So.
Yeah. So what does an associate chief of party in Laos do?
Hold hands.
With all volunteers?
All volunteers.
Is that somewhat similar to a team leader in Vietnam?
I don't know. Maybe there were three of us.
I guess I'm sort of asking myself that rather than asking you that. Okay, yeah. There were three of you, three associates.
Yeah, and we had Marty Klisch at the North. And I had the central. Can I?
This booklet here. Oh, I didn't have.
That did what you needed.
No, I wasn't using that as a pad. It just happened to be there when I put down.
Well, as a matter of fact, Randy Candia was at the time, but Ken Lewis.
Okay.
Was the other one, we were supposed to stay in touch with the aid and the Lao officials. Those areas, and we did a lot of traveling out to the provincial capitals to maintain our aid or allow contacts in the field.
Okay.
And we were supposed to do a reconnaissance of the sites where people were new sites would be established.
Okay.
Check the site selection process. That's right.
For job viability, for what?
Yeah. All those things. It was, livability,
viability, whether it's a need, what was it, how long will it last, security, of course, with that department, living arrangements, where would they live, what would they do, you know. And then when there was a group of volunteers, we would make some preliminary placements from paper. The four of us, the three associates and Chet. And then when they got there, after they'd been there for a week or so, what, then we would, you know, make our adjustments if the paper didn't fit, because we knew where they were going.
Yes.
And then we'd take them out, introduce them to the LAO officials and other things, and aid officials, etc., and then hold their hands, you know, be the person who would follow
up. But this intermediary step between the paper assignments and then the final assignments, what did you do? Observe people and figure out what their temperament and personality, and if it would...
That's right, yeah. I know with this, you know, King Cockler's this hard to get along Chow Queen, you know, with, you know, this guy's got a hard personality too, they'll clash, so we need somebody with a softer, you know. That as an example.
No, that's a good example. That's what I was, assuming you were doing.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to find out.
Yeah. And then, like I say, we basically held the hand. They didn't need a lot of hand holding, but, you know, we would, they're having trouble with their commissary order, or, you know, the money or something wasn't happening, we'd track it down. And most of the time, you know, those things ran fairly smoothly, so it wasn't a whole lot of that. If, you know, they'd sign up for the maintenance flights to Hong Kong, so we would, you know, hey, you know, John, you know, you're up in 2 weeks, think you can get up here? And you
okay? Oh, okay. So it was even being a travel agent.
Yeah, the maintenance flight was Air America.
Yeah.
I've heard this, that they would, well, a plane had so many hours, they'd fly back to Taiwan for
repairs.
Repair. And so on, you know. And so the aid people, including IBSers, could sign up on a list and said just there was no priority in terms of position, it's just when your name got the top.
Uh-huh.
And there was a bigger little plane going,
mm-hmm.
you know, they'd drop you off in Hong Kong.
Uh-huh.
And so you'd spend.
Well, they'd probably have to refuel
that. Oh, yeah, we refueled in Da Nang. Yeah, I took some hits on planes flying out of Da Nang. One was hit so bad in Beacon Fuel that we pitched engines and radios and stuff, kind of stuff in the South China Sea so we could turn around and land.
No. Wow.
But I mean, that was one of the things that we did to help the volunteers, was to, you know, to help them try to find their Air America or some kind of a flight that they get back in so they could get their R&R flight to Hong Kong.
Yeah, but you mentioned holding hands with the volunteers, but I think pretty interestingly, you also mentioned relations with the Lao officials and relations with AID too.
Yeah, and also we did some technical stuff, you know, somebody's doing a self-help thing, we try to get, you know, well, not just self-help, but whatever it was that they would need. You know, what was that, Small is Beautiful, who's wrote Small is Beautiful?
Yeah, I know the book, I don't know the author.
It's like Benjamin? Something. Anyway, that was big at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And when I came back from my volunteer and my IVS, or my associate chief duty, I stopped at somewhere in New York,
uh-huh.
I can't remember, which was a center for appropriate small technology.
Uh-huh.
And so if somebody wanted a press for making concrete blocks,
mm-hmm.
you know, appropriate technology, you know, or a pump or a piece of hardware that went into something to make for appropriate technology, we'd track that stuff down for them. Or we'd go to the motor pool and use our connections to get a barrel cut and so on. And
sure.
Get it shipped out, you know, that type of stuff.
Yeah.
We didn't do very much technology stuff because we weren't, you know advising on rice or pigs or ducks or trees or, you know. The volunteers were doing that. They were technicians themselves and they had a backup system within aid.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, we didn't do any of that stuff.
Okay. So what was your relationship in terms of working with aid and working with a lot of officials?
Well, it was, the aid was typically a tenuous, strained one because, you know, there were more, get out and get this done, pacification, so on. We were saying, you know, we're not pacification people, we're not, you know, part of that, we're out there doing good.
Yeah.
And so there was often a lot of negotiation, and you know, don't ask him to do that, or don't push on that, you know, that you're going to ruin the ability for him to exist or her exist out there and do these other things you want to do. Give him time, or by gosh, they don't put the well out there at the 6 kilometers from the village. You know, where the
yeah, who cares? Yeah, what's the difference? Yeah.
You know, you got to understand these levels. Yeah, but we got to have, you know, I need this report, 6 wells, and you know, to hell with your report, you know, we're going to get this, you know, that type of.
So you
the law was different, though. The law was one of, I think one it was Marty Klisch said that
he kept trying to,
the law official he was working with, I think the big word was, he kept trying to pump the guy up and get him, lift him up, get him on top of him. And every time he looked around, he said the guy was under him. Well, you know, it's because the law was quiet and tacit and
yes.
Theory, you know, and so on. And so a lot of the law, well, what we were trying to do with the law was to build a stronger type of relationship that was probably anti-Asian culture, but so that there would be more understanding and support. But the law didn't have a lot to do with politics, and maybe some of the security.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, they didn't have the resources. They didn't have much of an organization. They didn't have any technology.
Right. Yeah. Well, it sounds to me though that the relationship with AID is that you were more of a buffer between AID and volunteers.
That's right, yeah.
And something of an ombudsman, almost, in a sense.
Yeah, whenever, skip forward and we'll come back, I guess, but in terms of the chief of party, I think two of the things that I feel most successful about was that it so happened that our contract was up shortly after I became chief of party.
Okay.
And so we had to renegotiate the contract.
And that would have, when would you have been chief of party? Say, 67, 68, about mid-year of 67?
I guess, I don't think so, okay. But I'm not quite sure.
Well, because I'm thinking that volunteer was mid-year of 64 to mid-year of 67, or excuse me, 66, and then you had one more year of associate chief.
Yeah, so it'd be about right, maybe.
A month or so, somewhere. Yeah.
Probably look up somewhere and find out. Or something.
No.
But
anyway, the contract was up, and that's the important thing.
Yeah, and there were a lot of things I wanted in the contract. And, one of them was moving off the compound, the IDS office move off the compound.
And, oh, it was in the AID compound?
That's right.
Okay.
And I wanted more, I wasn't arguing for less connection or dialogue or, I don't want to say orders, but responsibility received from aid, but I was wanting more image of independence and not being tied to aid as an aid program,
mm-hmm.
as an independent program, because Chet had pretty much moved it, you know, as a direct arm of aid.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Mendenhall was the aid director. And,
yeah, I couldn't read your handwriting.
M-E-N, I think.
M-E-N,
D-E-H-A-L-L, I think it is.
M-E-N,
and he was a really hard-nosed.
D-H-A-L-L.
Yeah, he was a really hard-nosed.
M-E-N-D?
Mendenhall. Hall.
Yeah, H-A-L-L. Yeah. And did he understand the need for IVS independence?
Well, he came to it.
Okay, but you said he was hard.
Yeah, and it was, you know, he was there to, you know, count the pacified areas, the number of miles of roads built, and you know, mm-hmm. number of bodies of the Betet Lao. You know, that was the image of that time. But he had I guess because that was his marching orders. But he also had a human side to him. And again, one of the people I was able to connect on the human side.
Oh, good.
And it came down we had our negotiation, we got to a point and agreed to everything, but you know, some of the basic stuff that I wanted to agree to, you know, the really hard policy stuff, he just couldn't do it. And it just so happened that in the compound, in the bar, I was visiting with one of the spooks we had known, got to know, and I was saying, God, I wish I could, in the next 24 hours, get communication to Washington and back, but it took, you know, you were lucky, you could, and within a day, you could maybe get a phone call arranged.
Uh-huh.
You know,
yes, I remember those days.
And it took several days or weeks to get the exchange of mail.
Uh-huh.
And he says, oh, he says, tell you what, he says, we got this new, I guess it was satellite. Anyway, some kind of a compressed radio, you know, transmission. And he said, we'll send it, you know, tonight, and you'll have an answer in the morning, you know, after 8, after I guess it opened. And I said, great. So I got back to Dr. Gardner, or Mr. Gardner, who was the chief party then. What was going on? He got a hold of Senator Kennedy, Robert, and worked a deal, got a message. And when I went in to see the aid director, I mean, the senator got a message through the embassy to Mr. Mendenhall.
So when let me see. It went from IBS Laos.
Well, the Spooks to
well, yeah, to the Spooks.
To IBS Washington office.
Okay.
Who Dr. Gardner got a hold of Senator Kennedy.
Got to go on. Bobby Kennedy.
Agreed to a communication.
Bobby Kennedy or
yeah,
Ted?
Bob.
Okay.
Got a, agreed to a communication, which then State Department sent to the embassy, which then
wound up in the aid director's office.
Yeah.
And so by the next morning.
Something like that. It was the next
day. Yeah, it was
within 24 hours.
Yeah, it was quick. Yeah. Damn quick.
Well, yeah, and went in there, and we started the negotiation, and he said, Bobby, there's nothing to talk about. He says, I agree to everything.
Because he'd been told to.
That's right. And I said, oh? And he says, yeah. He says, you got some pretty influential friends in Washington. He says, what I want to know is how the hell did you get a message to them and back so quick? And I said, oh, I have some friends in, what was it? What do they call it in the compound?
Low friends in high places?
Yeah. But it was one of these things like the contracts office. That wasn't what it was. But was
program?
No, but it was It was the code name for the CIA people.
Okay.
And I said, oh, I know somebody in the contracts office.
Uh-huh.
He laughed.
So what did you got? You got to move off
the compound, and it was a big problem because they were afraid of security.
Yeah.
Because of all the compound. So we end up being close to the airport, closer than we really wanted, but that was close enough that if there was a problem, then we could evacuate to the airport.
Well, that was IBS in Vietnam. They were in Tan Son Nhut.
That's
so
right.
What the
right.
heck? You know.
Well, we weren't in the airport.
Well,
but
okay,
we were still.
We
were maybe a kilometer or two away from the airport.
That's close.
And it was a nice big house.
Uh-huh.
And we had the offices, and I wanted everything together, and we had a nice big offices downstairs, and an enormous room upstairs for the volunteers to lounge mm-hmm. around. And we had on the compound, we had another house for the volunteers.
For people to stay.
To stay.
Uh-huh.
And so.
So that's good as far as image. What about some reality in terms of the assignments or latitude
yeah,
of work? How much did you get there?
Yeah, we got veto power over assignments.
Really?
Yeah, we could say no.
Wow.
Go there. You know, I don't know that maybe I did. I don't know that I ever really used it.
Uh-huh.
I can't remember all the specifics, but there was told Brenda, my wife, we were married over there.
Oh.
Married in Singapore, and when I went to work that morning, I said, well, might want to start packing because we may be finished this afternoon. They may send me home, you know, as I'm prepared to tell them, you know, is that if you don't accept these, then you know, I'll recommend to Washington we not renew the contract.
Uh-huh.
And so anyway. That
wow.
Getting that deal broken and getting off the camp, off the compound, and getting this independence, and,
uh-huh.
and the office and all that stuff. I say that first it was the negotiation, then getting it all in place. Those are the two things I'm proudest about from my time in Laos. As chief of party, just breaking away from the direct umbilical cord of aid.
Well, yeah, I mean. You originally said, I don't know if you remember, you said the image, and I picked up on the image, but it sounds like much more than image. But there was some real substance there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not just because it was veto power, but if someone has veto power, that means that they have the potential for autonomous action, and then they become...
Well, but we were dependent. I mean, we had no other resources.
Yeah, no, yeah, yeah.
Actually,
you needed them
no
for resources. Yeah, you needed them
no
for resources.
No money, no gas, no car, no
but the
electricity.
Thing is, but they didn't have the manpower, and woman power too, to be able to do the kind of village-level work that you were supplying.
That's
so
right.
So you had resources too.
Oh, that's right. We had leverage.
Yeah, I mean, you certainly had leverage, but now you had a way to use it
that's right.
that was much greater than previously. And you said that it was more that, that Chet Brown had, had made IVS, your predecessor, had made IVS more of a, well, not immediate predecessor maybe, but he was?
Yeah.
So you started as associate under Brown?
That's right.
Okay, so he had, was he the one who very closely linked up IVS and AID, or is that what he just simply inherited?
Well, Walt Collard preceded Chet.
Oh, I'm sorry.
In developmental stages, and so things just kind of, don't know whether Walt, I think Walt was the first one, but anyway, it was just kind of getting there and the momentum, and it was, even AID was not that well organized, so under Walt, it was just kind of evolving and amorphous. But when Chet came in, things were firming up, there was more money allowance, AID was, had a bigger program and so on, mm-hmm. and then and all, or his lieutenants would call Walt and say, Chet, and say, you know, we want such and such.
Uh-huh.
Chet was a nice man, but he was more of that mindset.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not trying to be disparaging of him.
No,
but
no,
he would stand up, I'm sure, on the phone and salute and say, yes, sir. And
yeah.
I guess.
Well, no, I mean, if he has that sort of, if they have a mutual meeting of minds, then it's not an issue with them.
Yeah, another.
But it is an issue with you.
Yeah. And so, I mean, it was just, there was no design on Chet, it just it moved that direction. Because
that's right.
They got bigger and needed more, and they, mm-hmm. Chet said yes. And so
and they had a close said, cooperative arrangement. What's wrong?
And I said, now, you know, given IBS ideals and the type of volunteers we're having, you know, there's a conflict coming here.
Mm-hmm.
And that was before the thing in Vietnam. But of course, we had none of the problems in Laos like we did in Vietnam.
Into what do you, which particular problems are you alluding to? I think I know, but just.
Well, you know, the clash of the cultures and the organizations in Vietnam and you know, the Tiger Cage incident and,
yeah.
and Don's, you know, throwing down the gauntlet that he threw down, you know.
Yes.
I mean, it, none of that was, that degree of that severity or that type of stuff was on the horizon in Laos.
Mm-hmm.
But, and I don't know that if it's a different program, it never would have been there probably even over time if we kept the same trend going.
Mm-hmm.
But I was concerned about, you know, IVS ideals, the ideals of IVS being compromised by this close relationship. I was concerned that we weren't going to be able to do some of the things as an organization in Laos that we could do.
Mm-hmm.
And we had an awful lot of volunteers who were just, you know, absolutely opposed to the type of relationships there was.
With
and
AID.
With AID. And they were good volunteers and doing mm-hmm. good things in the field.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, if things continue that way, then there would have been a major explosion, a nasty explosion, with my perception.
Yeah.
And so one of the things I wanted to do, because I thought it was right, and also to be you know, prohibitive, was to make some changes. And the contract, I was given the golden opportunity of a new contract.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so
that's no, all that makes a great deal of sense. And of course, there was no throwing down of gauntlet,
right.
Either by yourself or your successors or anyone else. But you still did have a few rebel rousers.
Oh yeah.
You had Fred Braffman.
That's
we were going over the list. You had Lou Wolf.
Did I mention that on there?
I can't remember.
Fred was one of those people that you know he went native,
he would
come into my office and just come like a whirlwind, you know.
Uh huh.
Tall guy.
I've never met him.
Very energetic, you know, uh-huh. very articulate, very, you know, got to do it, you know, type thing, you know. And I used to think, God, here comes, you know I got all this paper I got to do. And when I realized, you know, the paper is nothing, it's the volunteers.
Yeah.
Know, what's here. And so help me, you know, he could have been my worst thorn, you know, agitating for change, but always listen to him. And every third time, there would be an idea. If not every time. And okay, Fred, let's think about that and we'd go out and do it. We'd get part of that idea, all that idea underway, get started.
So you found him actually very helpful?
Oh, very helpful. But I mean, I had to get past his advocacy and his anger and his native, going native, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I'm saying, I didn't have time to sit here and listen to you, Fred.
But
yeah. I would realize if I didn't, the paper wasn't that important. What was more important was to listen to him and to hear what he had to say, because as I learned, he had something worth saying, and I had to listen to it,
uh-huh.
because it made the program stronger.
Uh-huh.
But I couldn't do it exactly the way he wanted to do it. Or the
Well, as long as he was flexible too.
Well, it wasn't what he wanted to do so much, and of course he was an education volunteer anyway, so he wasn't responsible to me.
Oh, okay, so.
So he would just come in with these ideas and, you know, living as a, in the village.
He wasn't responsible to you. This was when you were chief of party, right?
Yeah, there were two chiefs of party, one for the World Health Program, one for the education program.
Oh, I always think of chief of party as single
when they
one.
When they left, they put the two together.
Oh, I always thought of a single one. So you were the Ag CD, and who would have been his boss in education?
I knew you were going to ask that. He made a power play for my job while I was there.
Uh-huh.
He made it at the, in of all places, he made it at the ambassador's monthly staff meeting.
That's an unlikely place.
Yeah, I mean, he was.
Unless that was the end game. Would that be in this book?
I don't think so. He came after Bernie. Bernie Wilder was there, and Bernie was great to get along with.
Uh-huh.
He came after Bernie. I can't remember his name right now. But
obviously, you've done a good job in obliterating the
that's
memory.
Right. That's right. So anyway, that was the combining of the two came after I left. But it was him. He stayed after that. He got then.
And he was.
Yeah, he took over.
El Hancho. Okay, fine. So. Put this in and go. Let me ask you before this starts in here. Let's follow up on the discussion, at least for the present here.
Okay.
And we were talking, well, I personalized it in the sense of mentioning Branfman only because I remember seeing his name in the list there. You know, and he was did become so famous because of the voices from the playing jars and all that, but also I mentioned Lou Wolfe, who I saw the other day, and Walt Haney, and, you know, he was education. I think he
had... Name's familiar, but I can't right now face to face.
He had done a lot of the work compiling data for the Kennedy Committee on Refugees, in terms of pictures and such like that. So, okay, but because if they were education, they weren't under you. That... At least those two individuals didn't have to be a concern of yours, but you did work with Fred Branfman. But was there, and you did mention that a lot of the volunteers were critical of working closely with AID because of the loss. Was that increasing? As an issue, despite the greater separation between IBS and AID through time, that is from...
Continued to be an issue?
Yeah, continued to be an issue, and did it even increase with time?
Well, definitely continued to be an issue, and yeah, it may have increased with time because I guess as more volunteers that came over, they were, you know, more aware of the anti-war, more involved in the anti-war.
Mm-hmm.
You know, later in the 60s.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, it probably did. And I guess if we hadn't, you know, hadn't done what we did, there would have been even more, been real hostile, real problems in Laos. But we had moved enough away that,
mm-hmm.
that even though it was a continuing problem, but I don't remember seeing it as that much of a heavy problem.
Okay.
I mean, that's not what constructs or jumps out of my memory.
Well, I'm trying to, as you know, we're trying to compare the two countries.
Yeah.
So there's always this bouncing back on issues such as this.
Yeah, I mean, you know,
whether or not
Vietnam
it resonates
was,
or
there
not
was further developed as a country.
Uh-huh.
The Vietnamese themselves were a lot more intense than the Lao.
Uh-huh.
There was a lot more American presence there. There was a lot more war. There was a lot more going on. And so, you know, it was like standing near the mountain looking at the fire versus, which was Laos, looking across the valley at the fire versus Vietnam as being in the pot on top of the fire. You know, it was just, it was two different total type of situations. But yet there was a war going on over there, and there was, you know, communists.
In Laos, you mean?
Yeah, in Laos. Yeah. There was a big aid program, and so there were the anti-war, anti-aid, anti, you know, that type of stuff in Laos, too. But it wasn't nowhere near as intense as it was.
From 67, when you were one of the, were one of the two chiefs of party, and especially because you were the ag CD chief of party.
And it was, education had, you know, 10 people and we had 150, something like that.
And they were pretty much concentrated in Dundalk and maybe Pocsay, you know, but...
One in Savannah Academy, one in Long Duval.
During your period, was there a pullback of the, what had been the old forward, quote-unquote forward areas?
Yeah.
How come? And how drastic?
It got hot again. You know, when I became chief of party, maybe as a historian you can help me, it was, you know, Johnson escalated in Vietnam, and so the Viet Cong basically pulled out of Laos. Not lock, stock, and barrel, but it was most of the people, maybe just the advisors were, you know, were left as opposed to having operating units. And so the war basically evaporated in 66 in Laos. At least, other than maybe the Bolivian Plateau or the, you know, up in the highlands, you know.
Right.
In those two areas, there was no war basically in Laos for about 67 through late 68, early 69, something like that. And I got into areas, you know, that nobody had been in since the French. No foreigner had been in since the French because of the communists. The highway was built from Long Bon to Vien Chan. I rode most of that highway, you know. But in 69, you know, we were, the escalation in Vietnam was met by Vietnamese escalation, and so the Viet Cong came back into Laos, and the war heated up in Laos in late 69.
I didn't quite catch the reason for the re-escalation in 69. Because...
Well, I'm saying the Viet Cong in
Vietnam.
Vietnam, you know, were getting back on top of the game after the American escalation. And so they had resources they could send back to Laos.
Oh, well, are you linking this up to the Tet Offensive?
To a certain degree, too, yes. Yes,
okay.
Absolutely. And so what I'm saying is that when the Viet Cong advisors were not in Laos, things got quieter.
Okay.
Or not advisors, but the operating units. So when they started coming back in, and Laos started getting more assistance, the Petet Lao from the Viet Cong, things heated up, and so there was the pulling back of those forward areas. And you know, the Viet Cong had, prior to that time, had never even, or the Petet Lao, never even threatened Vien Chan. Well, you know, the spring of 69, they threatened Vien Chan. And blew up an ammunition dump, and you know, my wife and a newborn child, I sent home early, too much early, before my tour was up. So there was
just
not
for
only
safety.
Safety, you know, finishing the tour, you know, go spend time. She's English. Go spend time with her parents in England. I'll pick you up on the way home. You know, so it was a combination of things. And she wanted the main thing was security, and that's why it was thankfully getting bad all over the country.
Okay. Yeah, the chronology. Sometimes there's almost chicken and egg sorts of things, but. The Viet Cong did take, at least militarily, a beating with the Tet Offensive because it didn't work out very well. So perhaps they were, in a sense, kind of pulling back and going into soft Laos to maintain themselves for a while. And I
don't know what the specifics of it are.
Yeah.
But
that's the time.
The chronology of it is that, you know, about mid 66 or 67, you know, things got
very quiet in Laos.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, we were all, farmers could go everywhere without any, and then late 60s, it got heated up again.
Well, when was most of the bombing that was carried on?
Well, on the Ho Chi Minh Trail, in the north and south, it was all the time.
Well, I meant more in the Plain of Jars area, stuff like that.
Sure, but I... There was one guy, what's his name, that we found out, I found out, that he was, at times they even acted as a forward observer for airstrikes, and we, you know, made preparations to get him removed from the country.
Uh-huh.
Because yeah. I think he quit and joined aid or something, I forget what it was. But,
uh-huh.
But, I mean, that was an extreme.
Yeah, that was going far beyond.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
But,
no, I just wondered if it was during this...
So I'm saying, I guess what I was saying there is that, you know, I'm not sure that I had too much knowledge or experience about the bombing in the north anyway.
Okay. All right. Because I wondered if that might have coincided with the lull in the rest of the country. If that might
I don't
have
think
been
so. I think along the Ho Chi Minh Trail there on Kinkoc, where it's a narrow part of Laos and where the trail kind of comes in deep into Laos, and then the two plateaus in the south, well, north of Pak Say and mm-hmm. Pak Song,
mm-hmm.
and in the north on the plateau, that the Plain Jars, that the bombing went on all the time.
Okay. That's what you meant at the north. You meant Plain of Jars.
That's right.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. I thought you meant like further north. A few provinces that the Patatlao had been given, you know, much, much earlier.
No.
Oh, okay. All right. So, yeah, I was... Your north and my north just didn't quite connect for a moment
you know,
there
Laos
during
that. Well, actually, that didn't exist as part of Laos because we didn't operate up there.
Oh, know. Right. Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You just didn't...
Yeah, if any of the IVS maps that you look at, you never find any kind of volunteer presence.
Yeah, so I mean, that's why when I think north, I don't go into that area. You know, it's just kind of along like this. It's just this half of the country.
Right. And but did you have people here?
Yeah.
Oh, former location. Oh, that was that the area where Pop Buell was in.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. Yeah. And it really does stick way the heck
that's
out
right.
there.
That's right. So you know that area, you know, along there, this doesn't mean much. And
yeah.
Down here too, because of Cambodia.
Right, right, yeah, and let's see, where's Bolivar Plateau here? That would have been...
Let's see, there's Saravan, that's probably right in there.
Right, okay. So there were some people around there.
Yeah, that's the present location. There, that's where Governor Chandler was killed. Well, Chandler was killed out east of Kinkoc. There was a fellow killed from
perhaps not within this particular period of time.
Right, but I was more kind of mean here, but
Look
at the clock too here. So
yeah. The clock is winding down as well. Give me a second here. I'm going to pause this. I just want this very quickly. And again, because the clock is winding down and I've got the release form to sign and I want to find out about getting this and some of the others. But you mentioned that you worked with a Dr. Thomas.
Oh, yeah.
And also Ambassador Sullivan, Bill Sullivan.
That's right.
Tell me about some of these guys. I'm particularly interested in William Sullivan because he was later ambassador to Philippines. So,
right.
Yeah, you know.
And he was the ambassador in Iran.
And in Iran at the wrong time.
Back, well, but he's back in the States telling them, hey, you ask, we better do things differently or we're going to have trouble in Iran.
Yeah.
He wasn't even in Iran when the hostages were taken.
Right, no, I know, but proceeding, yeah.
Well, Sullivan, unlike Mendenhall, was not a hard-nosed person. As a matter of fact, he was a Humphrey supporter. He resigned and left Laos to go back to be a foreign policy advisor to Humphrey when Humphrey ran for president.
Mm-hmm.
And then went back to Park Force in the Philippines.
Oops, maybe they're calling you. Yeah, so you've already had one knock on the door and there's probably going to be more really quick.
Yeah.
But he was pretty decent fellow to negotiate work with.
Well, I didn't really have to negotiate much with him, as Mendenhall dealt with. But
okay.
He took a liking to to my wife, not physically, but
married,
and she was expecting our first son was born when we were there, and so he kind of adopted us, and so we had, and there was this assistant ambassador, she remembered his name, Bob somebody, who, I think it was Charge Affair or something, and he and the ambassador would have months of luncheons, and they'd invite people over just to visit and so on, and so went to those a lot. That wasn't, he also, the ambassador had monthly staff meetings where that I attended, that was what I was talking earlier with.
Oh, yeah, yeah, during the one guy's attempted coup d'etat.
Yeah, but Sullivan was a good person, I thought.
Yeah, you described him very positively. And Dr. Thomas, too. What was what was his thing?
Dr. Thomas was from Cornell,
a
sociologist, and was academician, trying to be a practitioner in a rough world.
Yeah.
And so he was a very sympathetic and understanding, and he was, you know, torn by between two worlds. You know,
oh, yeah, very, world very
to do,
strongly.
The world to do right and be pure and so on, because that was the type of person he was, and the job he had to do is to administer basically a counterinsurgency program.
Mm-hmm.
It was tough, and I felt sorry for him.
He
was a little bit out of out of this water.
Yeah, yeah. I think what we should do is maybe turn off the tape recorder today. The time is getting along.
Yeah.
So, bye.